Good evening and blessings, and welcome to another installment of the Gist for Freedom of Space. This show is produced by acclaimed historian, educator, and author Leslie Gist, and serves as our weekly live online discussion to celebrate the African American experience by honoring all the people, past and present, black and white, who, with faith and focus, are preserving our rich history through literature, the arts, the skilled trades, and the humanities. We thank you for joining us tonight, and we'd love you to be a part of tonight's discussion by calling in with your comments or questions to 347-324-5552.
You are listening to the voice of Lynn M. Jackson, Dred Scott's great-great-granddaughter, founder and president of the Dred Scott Foundation. Quickly talk about your take on the court's chief justice at the time, Roger Taney. Tell me what you think about what you've read about what he wrote in particular, where he described black people as, quote, of an inferior order, and stated that those people, quote, altogether are unfit to associate with the white race, either in social or political relations. Comment on either those statements or anything else you got from Roger Taney.
Okay, excellent. Let's say this. Go back a minute and just remember the one line I gave you out of the Missouri Supreme Court, which said, times are not now as they once were. Well, I'm going to give you my opinion, okay, that I believe that based on the history of Roger B. Taney, which, by the way, was a very reputable and respected and well thought of. He had made interesting decisions. No one was arguing with any of that. In other words, had he not had the Dred Scott decision, he might have gone down in history as one of the best justices that we had. That was prior to Dred Scott. Now, in the past, it's been reported that he actually defended slaves in court and won cases for them. So we're talking about someone whose background and whose past up to this point is like draw a line in the sand at 1867. The person who's making the decision and saying these things doesn't sound like the person who was prior to 1867 and for the most part. Now, my thought about that is that simply this. There's a lot of politics going on, and the fact that the election where Buchanan became president, there was no tampering, okay, in the sense that he found out what the decision was going to be, who knows, but that he also influenced that decision. And they thought that when they made the decision, whichever way it went, this was going to settle the slave question. Well, they settled it in their favor for the country. Was he unduly influenced? Had he become more hardened? I don't know, but I do know that it's very inconsistent with his prior reputation. However, being that he's the Supreme Court Justice, and seeing that the new administration's coming in is looking for something in particular, this decision was made. Now, to the point that you said that these beings were so far inferior that they could not associate with the rest of society, that's baloney. When we show, when we say that, we usually show a picture of a black slave woman holding a white slave child in her lap. Now,
yes.
You can't be any more hypocritical than that, okay? That you can take care of my children and raise them. They call you mama or whatever. But
yep.
But no. So, you know, we all know that that's ridiculous. However, my point that I'm making is I do believe it was way more political than it was personal.
Now, when you say way more political and personal, does that also mean way more political than racial?
You know what? I don't know whether I should say yes or no to that question, honestly, because if you look at his past record, and I don't have a great detail on it, but one case, and I have to say I'm looking to verify this. I have this in my files, but I have not had a chance to go back and find it. That he supposedly defended a slave against a charge of rape. Now, that doesn't mean that as a lawyer, maybe he just wanted the money, it was just a case. I don't know. I'm trying to figure these things out because I'll be honest with you, Michael. I'm not going to take a, you know, far left, far right position. I'm looking for the truth, and the truth is always somewhere in the middle.
Well, I said at the very beginning of the show that I would defer to you, but I see Taney as the devil incarnate, that if Satan could put on a black robe and play the role of a chief justice of the Supreme Court, it would be in the person of Roger Taney. For me, it's not an issue of left or right, but simply an issue of black versus white. I mean, Roger Taney could see black people as human beings, as sentient creatures. So it seems to me that he would have done the right thing and certainly would have said the right thing. But let me turn it over to you because I want you to do most of the talking. I just want to ask you a couple quick questions. I believe we only have about maybe 12 minutes left. But apart from the fact that I see Roger Taney as the devil incarnate, let's talk about some of the things that he might have factored into his decision. His decision was made in 1857. Prior to that was the Fugitive Slave Act of 1793 and 1850. To what extent did those Fugitive Slave Acts affect the outcome or even the rationale of the Dred Scott decision?
Fugitive Slave Act.
Take your time. And while you're doing that, those who just tuned in, you're listening to Lynn M. Jackson, believe it or not, the great-great-granddaughter, and quite knowledgeable with that, of Dred Scott. This is the Gist of Freedom, normally hosted by Leslie Gist. For more information about our guest tonight, Lynn Jackson, log on to www.thedredscottfoundation.org or the Dred Scott Dred Scott Heritage Foundation on Facebook. Also, yours truly, Attorney Michael Cord, is interviewing Lynn M. Jackson, and he's trying to persuade her to come to Philadelphia sometime soon so she can share this wealth of information with folks here in the city of brotherly love. Before we get to the point, Lynn, where I have to cut things off, please tell us what you think is what's the most important legacy of the Dred Scott decision? Because the average person would simply say, oh, Dred Scott, the black man has no rights that no white man is bound to respect. Yeah, most people say that. That's a superficial understanding of the case. But if you had to talk for a couple of minutes about the legacy of Dred Scott, what does it mean? What did it mean and what does it mean? What would be your response?
I would say this, Michael, that here we have a man and his wife, because she filed her own petition as well. Their cases were merged together, but they stood together as one. And the new statute that's going to come up in St. Louis is going to show them locked together in purpose and in intent, because they sacrificed for 11 years, first and foremost, to preserve their family. Their legacy is about family and freedom. Grant and Harriet had two daughters, and they did not want to see them sold off into who knows what, who knows where. And so much so that they continued to say, yes, let's go to the next level. Let's take this as far as we can. It was dangerous. It was considered rebellious and seditious, on, if you will, I'll use that word again, for them to file against an owner. They could have been sold, separated, beat, killed. You know, they literally sometimes would put people in jail. They lost more freedom by being put in jail for their safety than they had when they were out on the street as an enslaved person. So they were courageous and tenacious. They pursued this over 11 years. They hid their daughters away for one, maybe 2 years in a place that to this day we don't know where. And they did all that to preserve first their family. They knew at a certain point when we went to federal court that this was going to become bigger than them, and yet they still pursued it. They paid a high price during their lives, and their daughters suffered somewhat after that. In fact, the youngest daughter, she was marred for her whole life because of this, and she lived to be 99. Their legacy is about family and freedom and courage to do what's right, to serve their convictions.
Once again, those of you who just tuned in, we have Lynn M. Jackson, the great-great-granddaughter of Dred Scott, providing powerful information. She's the founder and president of the Dred Scott Foundation. For more information, www.thedredscottfoundation.org. Lynn, I did, and you did as well, touch briefly on the Fugitive Slave Act, but if we can go into a little more detail about it, because we have a Fugitive Slave Act of 1793, we got a Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, and as I pointed out before, we have this Dred Scott decision of 1857. Couldn't there have been an argument that the hands of the Supreme Court in 1857 were tied because of the Fugitive Slave Act? I mean, couldn't an argument be made that if Dred Scott was, quote-unquote, a slave and left a free territory and returned to a slave territory, that he would forever be enslaved? How did those two Fugitive Slave Acts, if at all, affect the outcome of the decision?
Well, you know, I think it's just part of that political machine that was trying to keep slavery, as a foundation stone of the country. To say that, here's the bad thing about the 1850 Act. Okay, a slave could escape from the South and go to the North and be pursued and brought back. But not only that, if you lived in the North, and if you were always free, and even born free, you could be tagged as a runaway slave and brought back South. So there was some very heinous things about that. That was wicked and evil. And of course, there was no one to come to their defense. So the fact that this became the law in 1850, and in 1852, when Missouri said times are not as they once were, you can see the climate change. You can see the clouds coming. You see the darkness falling. And this, yes, most definitely played into that whole machine that led up to 1857, which is why I said earlier that who's to say that maybe this isn't exactly what he would have done had he not had some other influences that said, you know, this is the way it's got to be. I don't know. I'm not trying to defend him, of course. I think it was wicked and evil as well. But within my studies, I'm trying to be more broad about what was really going on. I'm not trying to, you know, like, bump somebody off and pick them, not picking on anybody. I'm looking for the truth. And the truth is that there was a system that needed to be preserved at any cost. And that was part of it. And 1850 and 1852 and 1857 was the penultimate. And we have not said this yet, Michael, but for those of your listeners who don't know, this was one of the very major catalysts that brought on the Civil War. And, of course, because of that, we did end up with the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. Also, it was the Dred Scott decision that pretty much nailed Abraham Lincoln's decision to further pursue his political career when he had previously thought maybe to get out of politics. There were a few things that happened right before the decision that also made him think, I should do this, but his presidency might be a direct result of the Dred Scott decision, being that it was the most heinous and infamous decision that the court has ruled in up until most recent times.
You know, you just mentioned Abe Lincoln. I don't want to get sidetracked, but in your research in connection with Dred Scott, and ultimately, as you pointed out, it did lead to the Civil War. Just briefly, what's your take on Abe Lincoln? Because my take shows Abe Lincoln as a shrewd politician who was a racist. And when I say a racist, I don't necessarily mean somebody who would enslave black people, but Abe Lincoln's on the record as saying that even if they get their freedom, black folks should never be permitted to vote, should never be permitted to hold office, should never be permitted to serve as jurors. What's your response, if any, to that?
Okay, I do not see him. I would not have said he's a racist, personally, and I think he kind of backed off of that, too. But I do agree with you that he was true, because one of the things that he gets criticized for is the Emancipation Proclamation, wherein it did not free anybody in particular.
Yes.
But I believe that that was a war strategy to change the outcome and give them an advantage by allowing the slaves from the South to go to the North and become part of the fighting force, if they would win, then they could end slavery. So his personal opinion about voting and things like that, you know, there are a lot of Abe Lincoln quotes, and people need to research them and weigh them for what they are. I don't know to say that, you know, maybe he found them to be so uneducated that maybe he would be fine in general, that they would understand how to do this, but I do not believe that he was a racist. No, I don't.
Okay. I got to tell you, Lynn, you are the most quote-unquote reasonable descendant of a known enslaved African that I've ever encountered, and that's laudable, because most people would think, hey, we're going to have the great-great-granddaughter of Dred Scott. She's going to be yelling. She's going to be screaming. She's going to be going off. You're presenting a very reasoned approach. And let me ask you about that, because here you are, the great-great-granddaughter of a man who was bought, of a man who was sold, of a man who was rented out like a motorcycle might be rented out. Why aren't you uncontrollably enraged?
Well, you know what? My personal thing.
90 seconds.
I think I'm just hitting my phone. I hope you're not hearing it. I'm sorry if you are.
You're good. You're good.
Okay, thank you. I can hear your cell phone. But listen, I personally do not believe that emotion is the way to resolve conflict or controversy. And so I believe that we've been given minds with to think and hearts with to love. Sometimes it's hard to love, and we should not love ugly and wicked, but we should try to think through and understand. And I personally do not have any malice towards people as individuals, but I hate what people do. I hate their behavior. I hate wicked and evil things. And so I will continue to speak out against that. And I will also try to be reasonable and fair, because, you know, even as you, as an attorney, you know that if a person is innocent but everything looks like he's guilty, what hope does he have? And we need to give each other hope, because part of our foundation is about education, commemoration, and reconciliation. I don't have the final formula for reconciliation, but I do know it's not unbridled emotion. And I'm thankful that, you know, we have the opportunity to come together and reason these things out. And I really appreciate your questions tonight. They were actually very good. Thank you.
And I thank you for your powerful information. It was very, very impressive. We got about maybe 7 to 8 minutes left, and I certainly want you to do all the talking. So let me just throw out another question I want to ask. In terms of, we talked about the three different aspects of the Dred Scott decision. Africans are not citizens. The Fifth Amendment rights of so-called slave owners being violated, and we just touched briefly on the Missouri Compromise. And the Missouri Compromise was an essential component of what led up to the Dred Scott decision. Tell us what that meant in your research. What did you find the Missouri Compromise to be and to mean, and how influential was it in the outcome of the Dred Scott decision?
Okay, yeah, very good question again. Missouri Compromise. And I alluded to earlier how Missouri is somewhat of a divided state even today. And it's kind of ironic that Missouri would be the compromised state. What happened was the slavery was obviously, you know, some people wanted it, some people didn't. So they came to a compromise where they would say, at this point, the next state that comes in would be a slave state, the one after that would be a free state, the one after that would be slave, and so on. And so the Missouri Compromise allowed everybody to get a little bit of what they wanted as states were joined into the Union. You have to keep in mind that we had states up until about where Missouri was when it came in. And all the land to the west were called territories. And so they knew in time those territories would become states, and the Missouri Compromise was a way whereby they could balance out states that were free and states that were slaves. So when we get to 1857, and I call them activist judges, because the Missouri Compromise had nothing to do with the question of freedom for Dred Scott and his family. Absolutely nothing. They just took it upon themselves to say, oh, and by the way, we don't think Congress had a right to institute the Missouri Compromise because, quote unquote, or in parentheses, this doesn't go along with our new program here. So we're just going to throw that out and say it was unconstitutional. And that left the door open for all of the territories west of Missouri to become slave states. We had what we used to call the Mason-Dixon line, where slavery was below, and we call that the South, and free states of freedom was above. All of these things were being challenged by the Dred Scott decision. So not only did he inflame the nation by denigrating the personhood of Africans who were enslaved, but they also challenged the Constitution and the right of Congress to pass laws and overrule the laws they had passed. This was putting, like, you know, how do you do it? Putting oil on the fire. I mean, it just made it rage out of control. So that is how the Good Compromise influenced the Dred Scott decision, caused it to be even more dastardly than it had been.
In the last few minutes, and by the way, those of you just tuned in, you missed a great show. And if you were listening, you heard the voice of Lynn M. Jackson, the great-great-granddaughter of the great Dred Scott. She's also the founder and president of the Dred Scott Foundation. You can get more information about her and the foundation at www.thedredscottfoundation.org. If you want to reach me, I'd be happy to speak to you about this or anything else. My name is Michael Cord, C-O-A-R-D. I can be reached at www.avengingtheancestors.com. Lynn, a few quick questions before we get out of here. I wanted to talk to you about the Northwest Territory, but I want to hold off on that for a second. Is it true that at the time they were married, that Dred was 40 years old and Harriet Robinson was 17?
Well, we don't know their exact ages, but he was considerably older than her. Yes, he was. And it's likely that he could have been about 17 and he would have been close to 40. We're talking 1836. Mm-hmm. And since we don't know exactly when he was born, it could have been 1799 or as late as 10. Therefore, I'm going to say he was at least 12 years. I'm going to go to the lowest end. Maybe years older than her, and after that, he could have been almost closer to 20. Yes.
And, you know, I'm glad you mentioned what you did about not knowing the exact age. And there's obviously a reason that we don't know their exact age, not like they had birth certificates like white folks. Talk a little bit about that. How and why you don't know, even as the descendant, you don't know the exact birth date.
Well, if you alluded to it for the most part, even though, as I said, the Blow family did write down the names of their slaves in the family Bible, they did not put their birth dates down, unfortunately. Now, that's not to say that some families have not, because I know that some have, but it just wasn't something that was important to them, because it was not. You know, they were not of their family. They were their enslaved persons or property as well. You know, I'm not so sure that people really considered them property so far back until maybe the Dred Scott case, but, you know, it just didn't matter to them. It didn't matter. They were not considered on their social level, so it didn't have to be. And sadly, we do know the years of their daughter's birth because we have records that one was born on a riverboat in Three Territories, the riverboat Gypsy. And technically, she could have been three, but she belonged to her parents who were. Now, Mike, can I say something about our statue in St. Louis?
As a matter of fact, whatever you'd like to talk about, go ahead. The time is yours.
Okay, because I only have a couple of minutes myself. I'm going to have to get off air.
Okay.
But we are creating a statue of the parents, Scott. And it is the very first one that will ever have been erected of them anywhere that I've been able to find in the world since I started doing this, which has been about 16 years. So it will be in St. Louis. The sculptor is Harry Weber. He is local, but he won a national competition, hands down, the blind competition. And he did a beautiful job. And if you do go to our website, you can see the maquette of our statue. And honestly, we would love to see it all paid off before we install it. It's sad, so I would love to ask your listeners to think about maybe making a best gift contribution to us to help us pay for this debt, because it is long overdue. and it is going to be quite a blessing to our city and to our country. And I'm very proud of it and looking forward to having that dedication in the very near future.
I want to ask you something that you mentioned. I'd like you to go into a little more detail about that before I get to my questions. You had mentioned that the family that initially enslaved Dred Scott, Peter Blow and his family, they actually freed him. Talk a little bit about that, because my research indicates that he, in fact, was freed. As you mentioned, I believe it was on May 26, 1857, a couple months after the notorious Dred Scott decision. So tell us how the family of the original so-called owner, Peter Blow, if they are enslaving people, why are they freeing him ultimately after that decision?
Okay, that's a good question, and I also like the word enslaved. You know, sometimes all these variations do come out, but I absolutely prefer the enslaved person. Okay.
Yes, yes, I'm so glad you mentioned it, because a slave implies that it's a thing, a beast of burden, but these Africans who were in Africa, they were doctors, they were accountants, they were plumbers, they were carpenters, they were soldiers, they were human beings who happened to be in an enslaved state. So it wasn't as if they were slaves. They were human beings like you and I. So we make sure we go out of our way. When I say we, I mean the group that I'm a part of, ATAC, A-T-A-C, Avenging the Ancestors Coalition, to make it clear that these are human beings. These are Africans who simply were enslaved. But go ahead with the Peter Blow story in terms of why his family freed Dred Scott and Dred's family in 1857. I believe it was May 26, 1857.
Yes, we call that Freedom Day here. We just tag it Freedom Day for them, because we've had programs on those days, and that is exactly the right date, May 26th. Now, backing up to the Blow family, first of all, as I did mention, they were never mean or cruel to them. In fact, some of the research that's coming out about the family as they try to research his parentage, they show that and the Blow family, by the way, can go back to at least the 1600s, I believe even further back than that. And they have meticulous records. But one of the things that came out is the fact that they were very strict on how they would treat their slaves, in that sense that they would treat them with dignity. And they would list their names in the family Bible, and they did not treat them as beasts of burden. So to that end, they were more humane about it, being in an enslaved situation, not anything good. But if you're in that situation, they were not constantly under the threat of being whipped and killed or, you know, those kinds of issues, raped and so forth. So the family was much more akin. Now, at the same time, the Blow family, Peter Blow and his wife Elizabeth, they had children. The earlier children seemed like they died fairly young, to where they seemed to have a second set of children. It would appear that Dred lived somewhere between the older ones dying and the younger ones being born, so he got to know them. In fact, he even grew up, he said something in reference to them Blow boys that he grew up with. So there was the fact that his age and the younger children, that they weren't that far apart. He worked, again, like I said, the house, so he was a little bit more around them. It was more of a, I don't want to say friendship. I mean, I wasn't there, but it was not a negative experience in terms of how he was treated.
Well, let me just say this, and of course I will defer to you as a blood relative of Dred Scott, but it seems to me, and I certainly would like to get your response, when it comes to slavery, it's all hell to me. Now, there might be some parts of hell that are hot and other parts that are even hotter, but it's all hell. I don't know how much credit I give to the Peter Blow family, and again, I will defer to you. I don't know how much credit I give to them for ultimately freeing Dred, because it reminds me of a line that Malcolm X said that I'll never forget. He said that when a man stabs you in the back, you don't thank him, you don't commend him for pulling the knife out, you condemn him for stabbing you in the first place. And I kind of see that with the Peter Blow family, but again, I'll defer to you as a blood relative of Dred Scott. You certainly know better than I do, but what would be your response to that, that the Peter Blow family, they weren't like John Brown, they weren't initially abolitionists because they were enslaving people. What's your response to that?
Okay, no, I love it. Listen to this. Now, and I thank you for deferring to me because I'm going to tell you the rest of the story on that point. We're going to spend a few minutes on this, okay?
Yeah.
First of all, I just told you the background of his growing up and so forth. Now, it was his father and his father's family and brothers and father who owned the place. The children he grew up with did not own him. They grew up with him, and they knew him for a long time. Now, fast forward, he sold the cars of debt by the owner, Peter, who then shortly thereafter died.
Mm-hmm.
Red has his travels to Dr. Emerson. He comes back to St. Louis. Dr. Emerson dies in 1843. So he asked the widow, after a while, if he could buy his freedom. Because
mm-hmm.
he had
mm-hmm.
saved up some money, okay? You know that.
Yes.
He said no, all right? So then he went to the report of suing in the courts, which he found out, of course, at some point, we don't know where, and a lot of people ask, why didn't he do it before? Why didn't he leave when he was in those
mm-hmm.
territories? We don't really know the answer to that, and I won't expound on those theories right now and stay on task here, but he did know at this point that he could do. And we believe that he was encouraged by Harriet and the pastor of their church, Reverend John Anderson, who was a free black abolitionist. Pastor Anderson was pastor of the Second African Church here in St. Louis, which is now Central Baptist Church. It's still ongoing, has never ceased to be. And so with that background, with that influence, with that help and assistance, they proceeded forward. Now, when they pursued that, the Blow children, who again now they were never his owners except to say they could have been those who would have inherited him, but
mm-hmm.
they did not. And had they may have set him free. But in this situation, they did not own him now, but they maintained a friendship. And throughout the ordeals of his trial, which, by the way, started on April 6, 1846, at the St. Louis Old Courthouse, went 11 years, there were 5 court proceedings. That's 11 years before the Supreme Court made their ruling.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout that time, now, and Michael, this is part I want you and others to hear. Throughout that time, the children, the Blow children, Taylor, Henry, Charlotte, okay? These, in particular, Charlotte's husband, they helped Red by finding attorneys, helping pay for some of the attorneys.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because a lot of times people were asking me, well, Mike, you keep talking about Dred Scott as if he represented himself or hired his own lawyers. Where did this come from? So I really appreciate you filling in the blanks there.
Yeah, that's not a problem at all, and I'm so happy to do it, because I read so many things that people write. I mean, and I'm talking about historians and
yeah.
the acclamations. People who do know, but again, you know, no one's fault. It's just that I love to set the record straight. And
yes.
and I have people who are backing me up, too. I mean, even if I was wrong, somebody would be correcting me. But at this stage of the game, we are all in sync. I'm talking about people like Paul Finkelman. And
yes.
Dr. David Koenig and folks like that, okay? And
let's do this, because you sound like such an expert. How can folks get a hold of you? I certainly want you to continue with your great explanation, but is there a website, Facebook, email? How can folks contact you directly to get even more information from you?
Okay, thank you. Yes, there is definitely a website. It is www.dredscottfoundation.org, and Dred is DREDSCOTT foundation.org. We also have the Dred Scott, probably Dred Scott Heritage Foundation on Facebook.
Okay.
And we also are on Twitter and LinkedIn, but I would stick with Facebook and the website for sure. And you can contact me at either the Dred Scott Foundation, which there's a contact button, or Lynn at, and Lynn is L-Y-N-N-E,
Okay. Great. I got to tell you, Lynn, I at some point we'll probably take some questions from folks trying to get in, but as far as I'm concerned, I'm going to have to hog up the show because I got a million questions for you because you just have such great information.
Can I finish telling you how they helped him? Can I just finish this, tie this up real quick at the end about how they helped him?
Yes, definitely.
Okay, I'll make it really quick, and I understand what you're saying, because time
does take your time
when we're having fun. Okay, let's get to this point. We get to the Supreme Court. Justice Taney says, no rights, blah, blah, blah. And so they go back, and they're now going to be slaves forever. Not so. As it turns out, Mrs. Emerson left long ago and went to marry an abolitionist who she did not tell she owned these famous slaves. When he found out by reading the newspaper one morning in Boston, he was furious. And he, with Roswell Fields here in St. Louis, got that case to the federal level, Montgomery Blair, Calvin Chafee, and Taylor Blow, there's that name again, they worked out a plan whereby Mrs. Chafee now, Irene Emerson Chafee, Dr. Chafee, and her daughter, who would have inherited them, they all signed a quitclaim deed for property, turning Dred and his whole family over to Taylor Blow, with the express purpose of freeing him. This was not a sale as I'm selling and buying a slave. This is a document for freedom. It became a freedom document for them. And therefore, he immediately went and posted with his own money freedom bonds for all four, Fred, Harriet, Eliza, and Lucy. And on May 26th, they got those freedom bonds. And that is how they were freed. The same family, the children of his owners, who stayed with him the whole time of this process, were the ones who literally were able to give him their freedom. They were not in a position to do it because they did not own him anymore. But once they were given that document, they immediately turned around and turned it into freedom bonds.
For those of you who just tuned in, you are listening to the voice of Lynn M. Jackson, Dred Scott's great-great-granddaughter, founder and president of the Dred Scott Foundation. I got to tell you, to the listening audience, I have done extensive research regarding Dred Scott, primarily from a legal standpoint. I'm going to talk to Lynn about that. But I got to tell you, I have never learned so much from one single source than I have from Lynn Jackson. My only question to you, Lynn, is when are you going to be in the Philadelphia area so we can have you come here? Because you just explained everything so precisely, so clearly, and so completely. Do you have any business in the Philadelphia, the Pennsylvania region within the next year or so?
You know what? Next year is going to be pretty exciting, I know, but I don't have plans, but I promise you that is one place I have never been that I so want to come to.
And well, I'll talk to you off the air, and whatever arrangements we can make to have you will be a wonderful, wonderful thing. One of the other things I want to get into, I'm going to try to squeeze in as much as I can, talk a little bit about the fact that at one point Dred Scott actually won in court, because a lot of people don't realize that. They thought that from the very beginning, he had been rejected or rebuffed in his legal actions. Obviously, in one of the first, I think you even mentioned, in 1846, after he tried to buy his freedom and was unsuccessful, he then decided to sue, and sometime around the mid-1847, he was in court, and his initial suit was dismissed. And I can say this, and I'm going to quickly get your response. As a lawyer, I always tell people that I am not a lawyer who happens to be a black man. Instead, I'm a black man who just happens to be a lawyer. And there's a difference there, because if I'm just thinking as a lawyer, I'm looking at this 1847 decision where the court dismissed Dred Scott's claim. And the reason they dismissed it, they said that he failed to present a proper witness to testify as to Dred Scott's status as a so-called slave. In other words, Dred or Harriet couldn't testify to it, but they needed somebody else, and because they didn't, the case was dismissed. But the interesting thing, this is what I'd like you to talk about, Lynn, is in 1850, when the case went to a jury of six white men, they ruled in Dred's favor. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, most definitely, and I love this part of the story, too. I want to clarify on the first trial, when it was dismissed, it was simply really an attorney's error. It was dismissed on the grounds of hearsay. Okay, and hearsay simply is the fact that you didn't go to the source. And instead of the woman who could have testified that they were, quote-unquote, owned by Irene Emerson, her husband was on the stand, and he said, my wife said, and when you do that, you remove yourself one party, and that's not acceptable in court, no matter who you are.
Let me say, you're right about that. The thing that troubles me is that when it comes down to hearsay is only bad because the evidence presented is not verifiable. It's not credible.
Right.
But to the extent that there was a witness who testified to verifiable or credible testimony, especially when you got two black folks here, Harriet and Dredd, and obviously, you know, they didn't get off the boat from Europe, it just seemed to me that the court was being hyper-technical. You're absolutely right. And from a technical standpoint, it was hearsay, but the reason why hearsay is frowned upon in court is because it's not credible, it's not verifiable. But in this case, everything that was said by that husband was credible and was verifiable.
Right. Well, I don't recall the exact text of everything else you said, but from my perspective and the way we approach this, you have to do the same thing for everybody. So even though it might have appeared evidence that they were slaves by the letter of the law and the spirit of the law, they still had to do right by them. And if this man had declared something through hearsay that was wrong and had been accepted, then that would have been a misdeed for them.
I got to tell you, Lynn, you are such a fascinating guest. I mean, we're not ending it now. We're going to keep going for another 30 minutes or so, or longer, I hope. But again, you know, if we can't get you in Philadelphia anytime soon, we'd certainly like to have you back on the show. When I say the show, I'm talking about the show hosted by Leslie Gist of the Gist of Freedom Blog Talk Radio, which provides powerful information with powerful guests like Lynn M. Jackson, the great-great-granddaughter of Dred Scott. Now, before we go into some other issues, because I really love talking about this whole legal stuff here, I certainly understand the point you made about the hearsay, and that's exactly why the court determined that information, that testimony, would be inadmissible. But, and then we had mentioned, and I'd like you to expand upon these six white men who later ruled in Dred's favor. But the interesting thing about that is, and this is where we get to the inconsistency or the hypocrisy of the law. The point you made about hearsay is true. The judge technically did what he was supposed to do by initially dismissing the case. And when I say dismissing it, I just mean dismissing it without prejudice, which means Dred Scott could refile later and come back to court with the proper witness, which is exactly what he did. But my point is this. After Dred won in 1850, when the six white men ruled in his favor, the case then went to the Missouri Supreme Court. And in 1852, the Missouri Supreme Court contradicted 28 years of precedent. And you alluded to it earlier in speaking to Leslie, that old precedent of once free, always free. Well, it seems to me if the court is so concerned about the hyper-technicality of hearsay and therefore saying Dred loses, it seems to me that it would have been supportive of the hyper-technicality of 28 years of precedent. I'd like you to talk about both of those, the issue of the six white jurors ruling in his favor and then the Missouri Supreme Court 2 years later reversing nearly 30 years of precedent by saying no longer does once free, always free apply.
Okay, this is what I love. This is my story. Okay, start with the jury of those who set him free. First of all, it was 12 white men, not six.
Okay.
Okay.
Now, I'm glad you mentioned it because there was some discussion about that. The whole notion of 12 jurors in the United States is a relatively new phenomenon, but obviously that happened even before 1850 in Missouri.
Yes, it was 12 men,
okay.
And their signatures are actually in the exhibit at the old courthouse that shows the names of those 12. So we can actually verify that.
I'm hoping that it is true. Was it a unanimous verdict that all 12 was just the majority?
You know, I believe it was. And
okay.
I'm glad you asked me that. I'll verify, but I'm pretty sure that it was. And
I mean, because nowadays, well, the way it works in criminal law, it must be unanimous. In civil law, it's a majority. So I'm not sure how they ruled in that case. Technically, it was a civil case and not a criminal case. So it didn't necessarily have to be all 12, but we'll certainly find out. First of all, I thank you for making it clear that it was, in fact, 12 and not 6. We'll just find out at some time in the future, was it a unanimous or just a simple majority. But go on, please. You're making a strong case here.
Okay, very good. So we had the 12 men on the jury, because when they came back with those right witness, then it was a slam dunk, like it
okay.
should have been the first time, okay?
Yes.
And honestly, I'm impressed by that. But like I said, here's something people need to realize. St. Louis is still, if you will, I'm sorry to say, but it's still pretty much a divided
yes.
city.
Good
or,
point,
Missouri
yes.
state, okay? So it's always been that way, but that's another story. So the point is, they got their freedom. But immediately, Ms. Emerson appealed to that. And when she appealed it, then it went to the next level. Now, her appeal, it was something that she insisted on having. It caused Fred and Harriet not to be able to keep their wages, and they were actually under the jurisdiction of the sheriff. And so this was an issue. Now, that was in, I'm sorry, I'm losing track. So Fred Scott saw himself as a man. All right, a man, and did what other men were able to do. Sorry, black men had no rights that white men were bound to respect, and that due to his ancestry, which was African, he neither was a citizen, nor neither could his descendants ever be citizens, and therefore he was thrown out of court because he didn't have grounds to be in court. And they further went and said that the Norfolk Ordinance, which had been invoked for almost 40 years, was no longer appropriate, allowing slaves to vote. So that meant that any and every slave, even those who had been free, even those who considered themselves citizens, were now non-persons. Indeed, they were deemed as property. This inflamed the nation, and the Civil War was an outcome of that. Having lost the South, we decided that the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments were the way to go to rectify some parts of this. But as we all know, today we still have lots of issues to deal with. And the Dred Scott Heritage Foundation was founded to commemorate that 150th anniversary and to educate, which actually by speaking all over the country, by writing, by doing interviews, by whatever means we can. To educate, and then the hope and goal that one day we'll be united in heart, spirit, and reconciliation is a goal.
Amen.
You have been listening to the, and I mean the expert on the history of Dred Scott, the great-great-granddaughter of Dred Scott, Lynn M. Jackson. For more information, log on to www.thedredscottfoundation.org. For more information about what we discussed tonight, as well as offering a financial contribution to the nearly 10-foot-tall statue of Dred and his wife, go to that website or call 314-532-5613. You've been listening to Blog Talk Radio Show, specifically The Gist of Freedom, normally hosted by Leslie Gist. And I got to tell you, Lynn, I really appreciate your information. I really appreciate your passion. I will be in touch with you. If we can't bring you to Philly, I'm going to try to steal you away from Leslie and have you on my radio show, because you've been that informative and that enlightening. Thank you very, very, very much.
Okay, Michael, I'd like to thank you, and thank you, Leslie. God bless and good night.
All right. And for those of you who are still with us, the party continues Tuesday night, this coming Tuesday, April 24, when we will have Gloria Brown Marsh. Who is that? She's the constitutional law professor, former civil rights attorney, author, playwright. When you talk about somebody who has the inside info on Obamacare, inside info on Trayvon Martin. And by the way, when I say Obamacare, I'm not saying it disparagingly like the Republicans do, like the conservatives do. I'm talking about somebody who's taking the step in the right direction to provide health care, affordable health care, to every single American. You want to hear more about Obamacare? You want to hear about what's going on with Trayvon Martin? You want to hear from a constitutional law professor, a former civil rights attorney, an author, a playwright, all wrapped up in one? That's Gloria Brown Marsh. This coming Tuesday, April 24, 8 p.m. here on this Blog Talk radio show hosted normally by Leslie Gist of The Gist of Freedom. We'll see you and talk to you on Tuesday.
No weapon formed against me shall prosper.
Using Blog Talk Radio. Goodbye.
What you doing?
Ran out of space on my phone, so I'm deleting some stuff. Bye, singing dog. Bye, goal.
I pronounce you.
Bye, wedding ceremony.
Stop! At Metro PCS, you get two free phones with twice as much memory.
Really?
Don't say bye to your memories. Switch to Metro PCS and get two free LG K20 Plus phones with 32 gigs when you switch two lines. Metro PCS. Wireless. Figured out.
Coverage not available in some areas. Sales tax not included in phone price. Excludes numbers on the T-Mobile network. See store for details and terms and conditions.
What you doing?
Ran out of space on my phone, so I'm deleting some stuff. Bye, singing dog. Bye, goal.
I pronounce you.
Bye, wedding ceremony.
Stop! At Metro PCS, you get two free phones with twice as much memory.
Really?
Don't say bye to your memories. Switch to Metro PCS and get two free LG K20 Plus phones with 32 gigs when you switch two lines. Metro PCS. Wireless. Figured out.
Coverage not available in some areas. Sales tax not included in phone price. Excludes numbers on the T-Mobile network. See store for details and terms and conditions.